more I read about it and the more I hear what faculty members say and the more I hear from students, one theme that comes out at me is that, hey, look at these strategies. If I used these strategies in my classroom, not just a student with autism would benefit, but every single person in that classroom would benefit from that strategy.
Welcome to Elevate Ed. This is a space for conversations around elevating teaching practices and applied learning for non-traditional students. From the mile-high city of Denver, Colorado, this podcast is brought to you by the University of Denver's College for Professional and Continuing Education, University College, where adult learners have been pursuing career-focused credentials since 1938.
Here in the studio with me today, Dr. Santhanam. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Speech, Language, Hearing Sciences at Metropolitan State University of Denver. She is currently developing the integrated supports for students with autism spectrum disorders in college, otherwise known by the acronym ISSAC. Her research interests include developing innovative methods of intervention to support communication in young children and adults with autism spectrum disorders, supporting parent-child interactions in families of children with developmental disabilities, and multicultural service delivery in speech-language pathology. I am so excited to have you here with me today.
Well, thank you so much, Cindy.
So this is an extremely important topic for really anybody in higher ed because the numbers of students with disabilities has really been increasing, right?
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about your thoughts on why that increase is happening. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, maybe some theories and some data points. And then from there, we'll start with laying kind of the foundation, the groundwork for why this conversation that we're having today is so important. Mm-hmm. And how it affects really anybody in higher ed. And then we'll start to dig into the topic a little bit more.
Sure. So just to give you some background about why we're having more and more people with disabilities entering the higher education system. So this is some information on history. You're not obviously required to remember the dates and the years.
That's good. I appreciate that.
So, you know, in the early 70s, 60s, before 1975, there was seclusion of people that had disabilities, any form of, especially developmental disabilities. So what happened is when people had any challenges, they were always placed in what's called a special or secluded system within quotes.
Sure.
So, you know, like a special school and that kind of thing. So they were not integrated along with the typically developing children. So in 1975, there was an act or a law, the public law that was passed, and that was called, I think, Education for All Act. And what happened after that is that the priority became that all children, whether they have a disability or not, should have access to free and appropriate public education. It's called the FAPE, the FAPE, and in a least restricted environment. So that means that you have to put a child with a disability or without a disability, everybody in the same classroom, and they go through the same kind of education, the same kind of learning that every other child has.
You know, okay.
This was really good, you know.
Sure.
It was really, you know, advocated for by parent groups, like policymakers. There were glitches through in the system, but, you know, by the time the IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, came out in 2004, what had happened is there were about 2 to 3 decades of children that had been through this inclusive education system, which is all fantastic. So that culminated in the IDEA, which then started, you know, making or mandating IEP services, which is the Individualized Educational Program for children that have documented disabilities. So if a child is in a school system or a public school system, and the child has any challenges in learning or communication, reading and writing, then that child has to be placed in the Individualized Education Program, the IEP, where then what happens is the child is eligible for getting all kinds of services that includes, you know, occupation therapy, speech language therapy, behavioral therapy, a special education classroom, all kinds of additional supports. So these are all really helpful for that child to not just be around other children, you know, of their same age and gender and all that, but also, you know, socialize and learn in that environment. So this act, you know, what the system has done, what the government policies have done, has really pushed for a lot of children with disabilities to graduate from high school, which was not something that they
could. The supports have been there for them to actually progress through the system.
Exactly.
And be successful.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and you know, like I said, there have been parents and policymakers behind this, behind all this.
Sure.
So, in addition to all of that, the early intervention system, which is something that every state provides in the United States for every child, the moment you take, you know, notice that the child is having some kind of delayed milestones, you take the child to a pediatrician, that person refers you to the state system, and then from there, you get free access to early intervention for the first 3 years or the first 5 years of life, which means you're getting all the kinds of rich supports that you need as a really young kiddo.
Mm-hmm.
So these two have really propelled, you know, education, not just academic, but also social engagement and learning and communication for all these children. So if you look at some of these statistics, I know that's a long history for why we're here, but if you look at some of these statistics from, I was looking at some numbers, and from 1994 to 2006, there has been a dramatic rise in the number of children that have with disabilities that are graduating from high school.
Mm-hmm.
So before 1994, there were about 20,000 students with autism specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And then between 1994 to 2006, there were about 200,000 students with autism. So see, from 20,000 to 200,000.
Yeah.
So, and then we know from recent data that by the year 2020, which is just around the corner, we're going to have about 500,000 students, especially on the autism spectrum, that are entering the higher education system.
Mm.
So this is what has driven the sudden rise. It's not like, you know, people with autism have, or people with other disabilities have never gone to colleges. They all have. They
sure.
always have. But the sudden rise is because of the supports that have been there, which is all good, you know.
Right.
So now we're in this point where we've done really good before 18 or before 21.
Yeah, the 21. K-12 has been, I would imagine, evolving, you know, as the student body has been
right.
evolving and the supports have been put into place.
Right.
So for the last, you know, 40 years,
mm-hmm.
K-12 has probably been shifting and morphing mm-hmm. and adjusting to these changes
yeah.
where it seems more dramatic
yeah.
for higher ed.
Yeah.
And the systems aren't in place,
no.
right,
for
higher ed to
yeah.
be able to support. In higher ed, we expect
mm-hmm.
that when students enter our classroom,
mm-hmm.
particularly at the graduate level, I think even more so, that when a student hits your classroom, they're at a certain level, developmentally,
yeah.
and their ability to be able to communicate or
mm-hmm.
adjust to change,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, their executive skills,
mm-hmm.
so to speak.
Very, very true.
Education has shifted more to being more of a collaborative approach, understanding who's in the room
mm-hmm.
and how to meet those needs. So this is just another layer.
Absolutely,
on
absolutely.
That.
Another point I wanted to add there is these students with disabilities don't always have obvious forms of disabilities, you know.
Sure.
So not everybody has like a physical impairment, or not everybody is with a disability on a wheelchair, for example. Several of these disabilities are invisible, which
mm-hmm.
means it's in your head and nobody can actually see it, right?
Well, and it's
so,
inappropriate, right?
Absolutely.
Sometimes
yeah.
you feel
yeah.
like, whether or not it is, I don't know, but you feel like it is not necessarily appropriate to articulate.
Right.
Even to a colleague,
mm-hmm.
let alone to the student,
mm-hmm.
that something feels off.
Yeah.
Something feels different.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how do I figure out whether mm-hmm. or not I should support the student?
Mm-hmm.
And how do I support that student?
Mm-hmm.
So let's
yeah.
talk about that a little
sure,
bit, because
sure.
I know you know a lot about that. And I think that'd be really helpful.
Yeah.
Does it help an instructor to actually know? I know that I've had students in my courses where I have received a letter of accommodations from disability services prior to when the quarter starts. And, you know, sometimes that's helpful or not. But then I also have had a hunch at times that I have students in my courses that maybe should have been connected, like disability services could have been helpful to them, but they didn't realize that this was an option to them. So does it help an instructor, faculty, professor to know? And if they don't know, what might be some of the signs?
What you're asking is if the person, I mean, the faculty or the instructor doesn't know if the student has a disability, how does he or she support the student?
Right.
Is that
exactly
what you're asking?
Yes.
Okay. So first of all, I want to like kind of backtrack a little bit about accommodations and how a student even tries to access these accommodations in a university setting.
Right.
So like I was telling you, based on the IDEA Act and access to the IEP system, in the K-12 education system, the school district, the parents, these are the people that are responsible for trying to get a child access to supports and services. But once this person graduates from high school and enters college, then at that point, there's nobody with you. You're basically on your own trying to figure out, where do I need to go seek the supports I need?
Good point.
So then you have to figure out where the office is, how to get to that office, how to talk to the person in that office, what do I need to take with me when I go to that disability services office. Now, every university has an office of disability services. Now, that can be called by many names. So when you have a young adult with a disability, the responsibility is on the young adult to take the proof of or documentation for their disability and go approach the disability services office. Now, this is something that people with disabilities may want to do, and there are people that might not want to do it, and they have the right to say no to the access to those services. So if somebody doesn't want to access services through the disability services office, then they are free to choose that. We cannot, as parents or educators or any other friends or anybody else, we cannot ask them to go to the disability services office.
Right.
So because as adults, they have that right to deny those services. So one thing that I tell families and I tell young adults is if they know that they've had challenges until high school, the day they graduate out of high school, those challenges are not going to just fly out of the window overnight, right? You are going to have some kind of challenge, minimal or not minimal. Sometimes you might need a lot of supports. So it's important that they go and tell the person in the disability services office that, hey, you know what? I have this disability. Here's my documentation. Please take a look at this documentation. And then please provide me the accommodations that the disability services office provides. Now, accommodations are any kinds of supports or aids that the disability services office is supposed to provide all students with disabilities. And this is done because we want to give equitable access to students with disabilities. So that's the idea behind accommodations.
Just to clarify, they often take the form of when needed, this student can receive an additional day or two, you know, in addition to the added on to the normal deadline to submit assignments or things like that.
Correct. Things like extra time in exams, things like extra time in assignments, the use of a recorder in class, the use of note-taking systems during class time, even, you know, accessible technology, like if you want a software to read your textbook instead of you reading your textbook. All of these count under those accommodations. And these are very helpful for a lot of students. Now, something to remember here is these might not always be helpful for all students. Like some of them might really not even need these accommodations. Or for some students, these accommodations might not even be relevant. They might have a set of challenges and the accommodations are telling you, hey, you have a note taker or extra time. And the student is like, I don't need that. I know how to do all of that.
Right.
So you have to start, you know, thinking about other ways to. We'll talk about that eventually. But going back to your question, whether the professor should know, I think it's important for the professor to know, but it lies on the student.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he or she wants to disclose his disability to the professor or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it lies on the student whether he or she wants to go access the accommodations from the disability services office or not.
Mm-hmm.
So if a professor does not know that the student has a disability, what do they do? So one answer that I have for that is, treat everybody the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Use strategies in your classroom in a way that everybody gets the support. It's just not a student with a challenge, you know. Lots of times professors wonder, oh, this person's quite quirky, or this person's just shy, or this person's being, you know, not following rules, you know, that kind of thing. And they begin to wonder, maybe the student has a disability. I don't know, but it's okay, you know, whether they have a disability or not. When we start providing the same kinds of supports for every individual in that classroom, the person who has a disability, who may or may not have disclosed his disability, also gets that support through your, you know, education and your strategies that you use in the classroom.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the things that I think is so beautiful about having this conversation and raising awareness around this is that, you know, I mean, a lot of these disorders are called spectrum disorders because there's a broad spectrum of how they affect people and where people fall. And I would think that there are some people that are low enough on the spectrum that maybe they've gone on undiagnosed, they've been able to navigate through life fairly well, but still, everyone can benefit from strategies that make the teaching and the learning more comfortable, more approachable, more inclusive.
Yeah, I think, you know, universities more and more are going to have to figure out ways to not just support these students, but even find ways to help these students find jobs. You know?
Yes.
So that's going to become a priority for
and be more comfortable. Yes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So what do you, you know, we, the reason we propagate or promote higher education for students with disabilities is because we know that higher education helps find better jobs.
Yes.
Higher education helps with more independence, not just in financial independence, but even independence in your daily living.
Mm-hmm.
And higher education also helps with you having a better quality of life, a better sense of self-esteem, like you feel good about yourself because you have a degree and you have a job and, you know, all those things.
Yes.
So I think they have the right to access all that. And one thing that, can I add this?
Yes, of course.
Okay. One thing that I've noticed is a lot of parents of young adults or even children with disabilities always keep thinking, oh, you know, a job in a grocery store to sort items or sorting silverware or washing dishes, you know. I have a student here who can read, who can write, who can even write a novel, you know. He has the ability to do math. He can do science. And I'm not saying sorting silverware and sorting items in a grocery store are bad jobs. They're not bad jobs. It helps you.
Right.
But you have all these abilities and skills. I would rather have that job be transferred into being a software programmer or a coder, or, you know, maybe you become a lecturer in psychology or become a professor in history or whatever your passion is, you know, like Temple Grandin, for example. She's a world-renowned professor now. She's doing fantastic, right? And there
right.
are so many more adults like her that do so well because they had the supports and they had the ability to do it and they had the willpower to do it. So, one message that I think that's really important for parents to take away from our conversation today is, I think, planning very early on transitioning your child from the high school system to the college system.
Mm-hmm.
Planning around, you know, what do you want your child to do? What are his interests? What are her passion, areas of passion? Like, what does she want to be when she wants to be, you know, a grown up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So starting to channelize this child's interest in such a way that this child can then go to a college and maybe and you know, eventually find a job. So like I said, you know, universities have a big role to play here. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, that bridge between the classroom supports and then eventually life, like getting a job and being independent. And for all you know, 50 years from now, that student might think, oh, DU or MSU Denver did this for me.
Yeah.
That's why I'm in the job that I am today.
Oh, so. We all are. Okay. And that's the ultimate goal. And the ultimate reward, right?
Absolutely.
What we haven't talked about, other than in the introduction, is your particular area of passion mm-hmm. and your area of study, which I think is super interesting. And I love how what you're studying mm-hmm. specifically can relate more broadly to so many different audiences.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So I'll tell you a little bit about what I'm doing right now and then go on to talking about the population that I'm working with.
Okay.
So one thing that I'm doing right now is developing direct support services for these students, which means I'm directly working with the students as opposed to, you know, addressing issues outside in their environment.
Okay.
So that direct support service is what you were talking about in the introduction, the ISAC program, the ISSAC program, where we're doing individual and group-based supports and intervention. The individualized intervention focuses on some of the skills that the student with autism wants to work on. We have a peer mentoring system here. So what happens is students in my speech and language hearing sciences department work with me as peer mentors, and they model some of the skills that the student with autism can then observe and learn and practice. So whatever the student with autism learns within these individual sessions, we then transfer to a group session, which happens once a month now, but hopefully we'll do that more frequently. At that point, we will have an opportunity for everybody to practice the skills that they've learned. So one thing that we've noticed from, you know, previous research literature and based on my experiences is that students with autism and anybody with a developmental disability, for that matter, need real life practice scenarios mm-hmm. for the skills that they learn. You know, sure. If you're sitting across a desk and you're teaching a bunch of strategies and you're saying, hey, go outside and go do these, it's not super helpful, mm-hmm. you know? And this is something that I've heard from young adults on the autism spectrum. Tell me. And they've always said, you know, it's nice, you know, when I'm learning all these, it's all fantastic. You're giving me worksheets and stuff. But then when am I actually practicing it? It's in the real life that you're actually practicing it. So we try to simulate that kind of a real life experience. We cannot, you know, I cannot go with this person to every classroom and every, you know, interaction they have every day, but we try to simulate some of those experiences. And sometimes we go out with them and, you know, kind of, we have some, what we call sessions outdoors. Mm-hmm. So we just do some of these individual sessions like that. So that's what we do in terms of direct support services.
Okay.
Another area of support that I am working on right now is for the faculty members. We're doing what is called a faculty learning community. And so there are a group of faculty, there are about 15 to 20 people in that group. And what we do is we meet once a month and we discuss some of the strategies that are helpful for us to kind of adopt in our classrooms. How can we start using these strategies, not just for those individuals attending the faculty learning community, but for the larger university campus? So we're thinking of, you know, developing resources that can be like web-based resources that we post on a web-based platform, that if a faculty member in the future has a student with autism in their classroom, here's where you go to learn how to support the student, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Great.
So we're working on those two aspects. I think of one as direct support, that is working with the student directly, and the other is indirect because I'm working with the environment, which is basically the faculty and the staff. So that's what we're developing right now. But talking about the population I'm working with, kind of going into specifics of what strengths and challenges they have. Now, autism is, you know, the definition says that it's a neurodevelopmental disorder, and the severity goes anywhere from somebody who can be completely nonverbal and have a ton of sensory challenges, all the way to somebody who can be having advanced language abilities. You know, they can be highly verbal, they can read, they can write, but they might have challenges understanding, say, for example, social cues in a conversation. Mm-hmm. They might have challenges understanding some of the kind of the metaphoric language, kind of, you know, the figurative language we use sometimes. Mm-hmm. They might have challenges in kind of, you know, picking up a topic and then kind of just going on and on about it mm-hmm. and not knowing that they have to give the other person a turn to mm-hmm. talk to, you know, just like what I'm doing now.
Well, this is all, the focus is on what you have to say,
yeah.
So you're doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. Okay. So,
but I can think as you were were saying those things. I think we can all think of people that we would consider quote unquote, you know, normal or not on the autism spectrum that certainly have these characteristics.
Absolutely. So we all have those, right?
Right.
Some of the challenges that these people have is around social interaction, like I told you, and understanding cues, having the sense of relatedness with other people, understanding, you know, what might the other person be thinking if I say this, you know, that kind of thing. And also around communication, like I said, you know, especially communication becomes extremely hard when I'm anxious or I'm nervous. You know, when I'm worried about something, I just feel like I'm at a loss for words, like I don't know how to say it. So these challenges happen quite a bit for adults on the autism spectrum. And they also, in addition, a part of the diagnostic criteria is that these people have what is called restricted and repetitive behaviors. I like to think of it as intense interest in a certain topic or a certain object or some kind of activity that they like to do. Like there are people that enjoy cooking shows, for example. Or there are people that enjoy talking about, you know, oceans and maps and that kind of thing. There are people who like talking about algebra or trigonometry or something like that. So, and we all have these interests. Like if you get me started on talking about gardening, I can just go on and on, you know. So things like that. Like we're very passionate about certain topics and we can go on and on. The difference between a person on the autism spectrum and one of us is we think we don't have a diagnosis or a disability, right?
Right.
So one of the so-called typical people, the difference is we have the ability to regulate our emotions. We have the ability to regulate our behavior and our actions. What is called executive functioning, that is something that comes very easily for us in most situations, at least. And we kind of take it for granted for the most part, right? For people on the autism spectrum and even people with other learning challenges, executive functioning, or the ability to regulate and control one's own emotions and activities and behaviors, tends to be slightly challenging. So what happens then is if I do not know how to regulate my emotions and behaviors and actions, I am running into confusions all the time, and I'm not sure how I'm supposed to approach a situation. So there's a lot of anxiety involved in all of these challenges around socialization and communication. So I like to think of it as a snowballing effect. You know, one of my clients told me once, he was a very bright young man. He was a psychology major in undergrad, and this was, you know, several years ago. He could learn, he could get good grades. But what happened one day is he asked, I think he wasn't paying attention in class or something like that. He raised his hand and he asked a question and everybody laughed. And so he got extremely embarrassed and he was like, oh my gosh, maybe I said something really, you know, nonsensical or something like that. And so, you know, he was really upset about that. So he went to his dorm, started crying the entire evening. And the next day he wanted to write to his professor that he feels embarrassed coming to class. And he didn't know how to approach the professor and tell him about this situation. He was just worried what the professor might think about him. And so he didn't write that email. So he missed the next class. So after that, he missed an assignment. And now because he missed a class and an assignment because he was embarrassed, now he's already lost some, you know, a grade, some points in the course.
Sure.
And so now he's like, okay, well, I'm already embarrassed. I have lost some points in the class. So how do I approach my professor now? What is he going to think of me? Or what are my classmates going to think of me? And then it went on from there. He just stopped going for classes, quit, and then dropped from the course eventually.
Oh, yeah. I can see how that would happen.
Yeah. So this is something that happens for most of our students because you start addressing one problem, and then while you're focused on one problem, there's multiple other things that are going on in your background. And you're like, I have the ability to focus on this one problem.
Right.
And then I leave out the
And then
rest.
Recovering
exactly.
becomes very, very,
very
hard.
Very, very hard. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the strategies that you have formulated to help faculty that have learners with disabilities.
So, you know, I've been digging into literature quite a bit for this purpose, you know, reading a lot about universal design of learning and looking into some of the principles in education for students with disabilities, specifically for students with autism. Some things that stand out from all of this, the more I read about it and the more I hear what faculty members say and the more I hear from students, one theme that comes out at me is that, hey, look at these strategies. If I used these strategies in my classroom, not just a student with autism would benefit, but every single person in that classroom would benefit from that strategy. So I'm like, you know, why don't we just do it then, you know? So we should all be doing
it. We should all be doing these things,
right,
yes.
Right. So some of the things that really are important, I think, one is having some kind of predictability in routine and having some kind of structure. One thing we know about, you know, about a lot of students with autism that I worked with in the past is if I have a certain structure and a schedule and I let the student know that, hey, here's what's coming after this event. Say, for example, in the first 10 minutes of class, we're going to talk about assignment requirements. And then we'll talk about, you know, the topic for the day. We'll do a 10-minute lecture. And then maybe we'll work on a worksheet. And then we'll have a group activity, some kind of outline for that class. And this doesn't have to be just structure for a certain class, but just structure for the entire course. You know, structure for how exams are going to be organized. It's both within the design of the course and the way the course is delivered. So when we start thinking about following a certain set of structure, it just makes things more predictable for the student, for the learner, right? And even those students who have anxiety of like, oh my gosh, what is she going to do in class today? Or what are we going to have to do? Is she going to put me in a group? Or is she going to make me answer a question?
Stand up and talk?
Yeah. Right? So is she going to make me answer a question that I don't know the answer for? I haven't read from, you know, the assignment yesterday, or I didn't read the book yesterday. What is she going to make me do?
Mm-hmm.
So I like to go into class every day and write an agenda on the board. It doesn't have to be any fancy photographs and visual schedules and things like that. I just use like a plain marker and a whiteboard or a chalk and a blackboard and just write agenda for today. Here's what we're going to do. 5 items. And as I complete each of those items, I like to check them off. That way the student knows that, you know, this is done and then this is done. So I kind of scratch them off or I place a check mark. This kind of predictability, I think, is very helpful both in online classroom and in-person classroom. So in online classrooms, having some kind of schedule that morning or the first day of the week or something like that, you let students know, hello, welcome everybody, week 5 or week 6, or, you know, here's what we're going to do, A, B, C for this week. And then make sure that once you're done with A, go to B. Then once you're done with B, go to C. That kind of routine, you know, helps really all students.
Absolutely. So that's and the instructors.
Absolutely, yeah. So it helps, you know, it helps get all the anxiety around, you know, how, what am I doing or how much time I have for something and all that. So that planning really helps. The second thing that I've noticed in classes, you know, talking about the application of what we do, like why we do it. So starting each class or even each topic, talking about, you know, hey, here are some topics that we're going to talk about. How is this topic relevant for your job in the future? Or how is this topic relevant for your exam? Or how is this topic relevant for your experience in graduate school? You know, that kind of thing. It just makes even the students who are less motivated want to learn, you know?
And it's amazing how consistent that is with a lot of what we talk about for meeting the needs of adult learners who have very busy lives and a lot going on, and they, you know, and if the more you can make those connections,
right,
you're going to enhance and increase their ability to be able to learn.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I can give you an example of what happened last week in class. I was talking about, you know, in speech and language hearing sciences, we have a course where we're analyzing language samples. And so I was talking to students about how to separate out the morphemes in, you know, in bound morphemes and root morphemes. I'm not going to go into the details of all that. I'll spare you from all that. But then, so it's going into details of that. And then the students were like, what are we going to do with this? One student raised his hand and he asked me. And I was like, I said, here's what we're going to do. It helps you when you become a clinician, when you become a speech language pathologist, you'll have language samples of children that you're gathering and you're collecting and you're analyzing it. So you want to know what morphological markers this child is using, so you know what's normal and what's not normal. So that kind of thing, you know, simple things, if you tell students, they're like, oh, that makes sense. Now mm-hmm. I really want to learn.
And now I'm invested in it.
Exactly.
Yes. Right.
And this happens a lot with students with autism, where they don't have a motivation for learning unless the topic is something that they're really passionate about, or something that they really want to learn about.
Mm-hmm.
Like one student with autism told me, you know, I want to become an engineer and I want to know how to fix things. Why am I having to take a class in psychology? So,
I'm drawing that connection. I'm sure once they realize the connection mm-hmm. between things breaking and,
yeah.
and that you have to understand the psychology behind what happens when, you know,
sure.
when things break, and then you connect that up
yeah.
with fixing things and designing things.
Yeah.
There's a lot of psychology behind that.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, we always have to sit down and kind of figure out why we're doing something. And that's really helpful for all students, I think.
Absolutely. Great. So normally at the end
yeah.
of all of the podcast episodes, I love to ask for takeaways
okay.
that can be directly applied, very actionable things that our listeners can use right away to enhance their
mm-hmm.
their teaching and the student's learning experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've just given us one really great one, and that is to be very transparent with the order
mm-hmm.
and have a schedule, stick to the schedule, make sure that the people know how they're progressing through
yeah.
the deliverables and the expectations
right.
in a given class or a given weekly module,
right.
If it's an online class. What are a couple of other things that you can think of that are really helpful?
One thing I think might be really helpful would be calming strategies, putting them in place kind of proactively as opposed to coming up with, you know, behavioral modification or conduct, you know, I don't know, resolution or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's just extremely helpful that way when we let students know that, you know, here are some calming strategies to practice. Like one thing I do is I let students, you know, the predictability helps with calming. One thing I let students do is take frequent breaks during class. If it is a 1 hour class, have at least 5 minutes break time within the 1 hour class.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't have to be them checking their cell phones, but, you know, getting up and stretching, going outside, taking a fresh breath of air, you know, all of that counts. Even practicing some kind of breathing for some students might be helpful. Some students find that funny and they don't want to do it. That's completely okay. But for some students, they just want to sit in a corner and just take some deep breaths.
Mm-hmm.
It just helps to calm down.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps the instructor too. You know?
Oh, yeah.
These kinds of calming strategies are helpful. And I let students, you know that feel free to do these things when we have that break time. And don't feel shy or embarrassed that you're doing something. Like I have a bunch of sensory toys in my classroom, things like, you know, a squeeze ball or a Play-Doh or something like that, that
mm-hmm.
they can kind of, you know, play with during those break times, especially.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, that kind of calms your mind down. You're not focusing on, oh my gosh, what all I have to do in my life, you know, instead of that. You're thinking about, you're just focusing on that sensory, you know, that experience, and maybe that's helping you calm down. Like there are students in my class that like to doodle,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I tell them, just go, you know, go for it. Just keep doodling. I don't care, as long as you're listening and as long as you're participating and engaging. I think that kind of flexibility and willingness to be okay with all types of learning styles within the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Like some people can learn only when they have music on, or some people can learn only when they're doodling on the side, you know,
right.
that kind of thing. That's also very helpful as instructors for us to practice, I think.
Well, and I think that articulating
mm-hmm.
these things, even if you say midway through the course, we're going to take a break just to have a few deep breaths.
Yeah.
Well, maybe somebody will laugh about that,
mm-hmm.
but I think articulating that you're creating a space for that just normalizes for everybody. If there are people in the room that need to take a couple
yeah.
of really deep breaths,
yeah.
you know, and the more that you can normalize the fact that people might be feeling anxious or they might be feeling overwhelmed, that's going to take some really great strides to just making it a more comfortable place for everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just wanted to add another thing that I think has come up a lot, and I think it's a very helpful strategy. Not being offended by a lot of questions or comments that some students make, you know. One thing that professors ask me when they are working with a student on the autism spectrum is the student is really rude or impolite in the classroom to me and to the peers. Now, I'm not saying that they are not rude or that they cannot be, but I think it's important to understand that a lot of students with autism are often misunderstood. You know, they tend to use kind of blunt language sometimes. They can be abrupt. They're very black and white kind of thinkers. And so the way they ask, or the tone in which they ask, or even the lack of facial expressions when they ask, these things sometimes get interpreted as, oh, the student is really rude to me, or they're just being mean to everybody, you know. I think it's helpful to give some benefit of the doubt, you know. Maybe they are rude. I'm not saying maybe they're not, you know. Maybe they're not. So we don't know. So waiting it out, not just like as soon as a student makes the first comment that's rude or blunt, not just immediately going to go and fix it, but waiting and giving that student a couple more chances. See if this keeps repeating again and again. You know, if this is a pattern that you're seeing, like maybe five times throughout in the entire week, you're seeing that the student is being rude. Or trying to figure out what about that statement was rude, or why was that student saying what they said. You know, sometimes professors get offended when students keep asking the same questions over and over and over again. Or you might have given instructions very clearly and the student might be like, I didn't understand what you said, tell me that thing again, you know. And the way they say it, you know, then instead of saying would you please, instead of like that,
very direct.
Very direct. So in those places, I think we can troubleshoot from our side what things that we can take care of. Say, for example, giving that instruction in a visual format as opposed to just an auditory or a verbal instruction. Writing it somewhere or having some kind of flow chart. Like I told you, when you finish this step, go to this step, then do this step, that kind of thing. Some kind of flow chart. That's very helpful. Just showing that these are the instructions and here is where you go to access these instructions. That helps resolve most of those problems. Right? And so those are some things that we can kind of troubleshoot before we address why that person is rude or not. And so when and if a person is really rude and this becomes a pattern in class and the person's rude to the peers and everybody, I think it's also helpful to talk to that student directly in the absence of others, you know, one-on-one, just let them know that, hey, here are the university rules and policies on behavior within a classroom setting. These are professional expectations within a classroom setting. And I would really appreciate if you followed these rules. That way it's helpful, not just for you, but for everybody in the classroom. Because I would also like for somebody else in the classroom to have a chance to talk, for example. You know, sometimes we've noticed that students with autism tend to be kind of monopolizing a conversation or something like that. So just letting them know that here's what we're facing. They might not know that this is a problem. So it's important for the professor to just let them know that here's a problem that's happening and here's how you can fix it. And for all you know, they might actually receive it very well. And they might just stop being rude or stop monopolizing or knowing when to take their turn to talk. They might still talk. They might still want to raise their hand or, you know, frequently, but they'll know that here's my turn and this is when I need to talk. Generally, people with autism are excellent with rules. Again, I, you know, I'm making a very generalized comment here, but, you know, but this is something that we see in a lot of people that when you say something that you say that this is a rule, they like to follow it because that gives a sense of predictability. That lets them know that, hey, this is what we need to do. So going back to kind of summarizing what I was saying, you know, being flexible a little bit and not having our ego on our head when we're, you know, just allowing some time and some exploration of why the student did what they did is very helpful for us. You're kind of taking a backseat and watching. That way we, you know, eventually we support that student and we're also supporting the other students in the class.
Well, yeah, and that's what I was just thinking, is that all of these takeaways truly are best practices for managing students in classrooms. Mm-hmm. And so I think really just giving students the benefit of the doubt, especially if you get a bit of communication that comes from them that is off-putting, really, in any way.
Yeah.
You know, I think that it helps to know the statistics and to know that there are, in fact, rising numbers of students with disabilities that are entering higher ed. And through that lens, we can maybe adjust our gut reaction a little bit, you know, to all students, to, you know, check ourselves a little bit as faculty and stop and think, okay, what is the source? What might the student have going on? And I loved your thought about, or your idea about looking for patterns, giving enough time to see, is this a one-off interaction or is there a pattern here? And if there's a pattern here, then what might be causing this? So, well, this has been really informative, super helpful, and I so appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk about this, and because it's a very important topic,
without a doubt,
for young adults, for parents of young adults, for universities and, you know, professors in the higher education system.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Have a topic you're passionate about as it relates to teaching and learning with an adult population? You can join our conversation by submitting suggestions or interview ideas through our website, universitycollege.du.edu/elevated. I hope you'll subscribe and share this podcast with colleagues and friends who are also passionate about effective teaching and learning strategies for post-traditional students. Thanks for listening.